You know, I don't like this machine, don't you? Because it makes a horrible noise and makes me very hot. Both of which are very selfish considerations. So I shall martyr myself for a moment. Suppose we do a sign like this. That's Chinese for a man. Yes, an ordinary man, that's the important thing. Now the Egyptian for the same thing used to be that. See, the Egyptians were rather precise about anatomical forms. It's a pair of legs with feet on. The Chinese were very graceful, so they didn't mind the legs swinging into the feet, and it made a very nice, pretty, cursory form. Which you preferred, this formalism of the Egyptian or that subtle aesthetic of the Chinese ideograph? Well, those of you who like the Chinese are a sensuous lot of self-indulgers. And those who like the Egyptian are a lot of square, solid blockheads. Now, suppose we accept that this is shorthand for a man, a pair of legs. Why would they choose a pair of legs? Because there aren't many bipeds on Earth. You know, there's the cassowary and the kiwi and an ostrich. One or two other bipeds apart from man. But Aristotle says man is the featherless biped. So, for shorthand, it is quite convenient to draw a pair of legs. But then, supposing you see that pair of legs and you know it represents a man, what part of the man does it represent? His going power, his standing up power, his divisive power, because he's got his legs separate. You see, the problem with translating an ideograph is that you can produce thousands of different translations, all correct, but all referring to something totally different. The going power, the standing power, the divisive power, the mark of the man who can stride and measure. Any sinologist looking at that could give you a translation of it, and unless you read all of the translations and the others that are not yet made, you would not have grasped the depth of the ideographic meaning. Hence, read Ping Fo Pong is quite permissible. Now, I'll wind it back a bit and show another structure, which we were talking about a little last night. This is the human being again. This time, I haven't drawn a very quick cursive form. I've drawn three circles and the connecting line and three symbols we call letters. But these same things that are letters to us could be drawings of something to somebody else. This red circle represents the zone of your red dragon appetite, the zone of the tummy. The thematic nature of the Greeks means red appetite. And at the top here, there is a blue circle. I've done it blue because blue is a cool colour and symbolises your intellect. And I put a P in it, and the P, to us, a P, could be a drawing of something quite different, could it not? If you saw a P, how would you translate it? What would you mean? Now, stop. Stop anticipating. Well, there's a thing in the dictionary, a word called penalty. It means to remove the genital organ of an offender. You see how tricky this problem of translation is. The penile code which may be in the nose and it may not, according to whether you've been fighting in Korea or Bermondsey. Now, in the middle I put an O, and I tried to draw this O, but the pen had dried up, which is very symbolic. You see, it's very important in Sufi philosophy, the esoteric philosophy of Islam, to utilize every so-called accident. And the path in the middle that I have drawn has come out faintly, and I couldn't have been better if I had done it faintly on purpose, because it represents an invisible field of power. An invisible field of power, and I've written an O in it. And that same letter O could be simply a circle. And the circle could mean a zone for consideration. It could mean a zone locked up. It could be a zone circumscribed. Or it could be a letter O. But if we ask ourselves what the letter O means, when we form a letter O in the mouth, we have to make, as far as we can, a spherical form. Otherwise, we won't get the O. If we make it too tight and wiggle the lips about and try to say O, it doesn't convey precisely the sphere that we want. But if we say with the rounded mouth O, like Shakespeare's wooden O, the theatre in which he played, we are getting near to the original significance of that two-dimensional letter which has length and breadth and no depth on the surface of this perspex. We can translate it into a three-dimensional sphere of influence. We can then say that this zone here, which represents the chest on the human being, is the center of an infinite field of sentient power. SP. Observe, sentience, sensuality, sensuousness, sensibility. All these words have the same root. Sentire, to feel, to know, and yet I haven't put it in the feeling center in the heart. Now we're going to see why we haven't, because when feeling is at rest, that is, making no judgment, that feeling is not manifest. There is an infinite field of sentient power, but it can go into a state of perfect equilibrium called pralaya in Sanskrit, and in that state it would manifest nothing. In science, in physics, it is called maximum entropy, when all the energies of the world are conceived to be asleep, to have balanced themselves out over infinite space. And because of their equal distribution, there is no outstandingness. Outstandingness, in English from Latin, is existence. To exist is to stand out. If all the energy is perfectly equably distributed, nothing stands out. And that state is called pralaya. It means that the positing of differences, PR, the pra, has laid itself down and gone to sleep. Now we know that power can do this because we actually do have a capacity to go to sleep. What do we do when we go to sleep? We deliberately remove the differentials of consciousness. We try to darken the room, we close our eyes, we try to get silence, and we hope that no kippers are burning on the landing below. That's if we live in those kind of digs. I don't know whether you've been enjoyed fame in the theatre and been on tour, because if you have, you'll know what I mean by the smell on the landing. It's anybody else's meal except yours. Creeping along without permission, getting under the door and creeping into the bed, and disturbing consciousness. And this is tremendously important, because if you had personally cooked that kipper on your floor, you could sleep in it quite happily, because it would have been your will was caught it. You can make a mental note that every time something occurs, because you personally have willed it without impedance, that is bliss, even if it is a kipper on the landing. But if somebody else cooks the kipper, same shop, same price, same condition, all Manx, last year's deep freeze, it will smell horrible, because it is not your will to encounter the kipper at that moment. Sentire, to feel, is also the basis of to know. You wouldn't think that a Chinese word would be similar to an English word, would you? An ancient Chinese word, kuang and kno in English, are actually the same word. To see, to observe, to kno means to fasten, to seize on, to grasp a content of consciousness. In this middle zone of the chest, drawn faintly by divine accident, and coloured purple, because purple is made pigmentally to an artist of blue and red, we mix the blue and red together and we get purple, the colour of royalty. The blue means intellectuality, know-how, and the red means activation, application of know-how. The two together are purple. The purple is the colour, the phallic colour, of primary initiative. There is a funny word called puce, which is considered to be a very obscure word in the dictionary, and a very obscure colour out of the dictionary. It refers to phallic drive. It is the primary head of all beings, where the head means the power that actively divides. He-ad. In some parts of the country they would actually pronounce that word, head. Does anybody know what part of the country you go to hear the people amongst the populace in country districts saying head for head? And they are actually giving you the original pronunciation of that word, he-ad, head. Now he is the symbol of life principle itself, and would correspond with this heart field not making a judgment, but the ad, as in Adonai, Lord, means the ability to divide. So we can say this purple, this red, and this blue, in the purple state, are not yet polarized. We could say that this chest center actually has hidden in it blue and red, intellection and sensuousness. And when it comes into the world in the body of a child, that feeling focuses into the body, and it experiences the body as a restraint, on infinite potential activities. Your body is a system of restraint. It has an integument of skin that stops consciousness spreading infinitely, and it has subdivisions of cells, each cell with a skin which stops the consciousness spreading, so that by means of the skins around each of your organs, you can actually finite, limit, restrain, constrain a given function. So that by the skin around the kidney, you are able to confine kidney function. By the skin around the liver, you confine liver function. And this confining process depends upon the generation of skins. Every cell in your body has got a skin. Every group of cells has a super skin around the little skins. And all of these skins have a big thick skin around your whole body, the integument that holds you together and allows you to conceive yourself as separate from another zone in clothes in another skin. So we have to say this mysterious O means nothing, not a thing, and all things in potentiality. So the O there gives us the idea that there is an infinity of possibilities. I was talking to a mathematician today, and I wrote an equation down, S equals P to the nth plus S. And he looked at it and said, that is mathematical rubbish. So I said, translate it into mathematics. He said, it must mean 0 equals P to the nth plus infinity. I said, is that rubbish? He said, no, that's all right. And I said, in this equation here, you have written the whole of Buddhist philosophy in one equation. Now, Buddhism is a very interesting religion, which is claimed by deep thinkers not to be a religion at all, because it dispenses with the idea of a god outside you. And instead of using a god, it uses the idea of a full void. What does void mean? V is developmental potential. Oid means form. Potentiality of form is the meaning of void. Now, when I wrote this equation, S equals P to the N plus S, I translated it, the observing sentience equals the precipitations of the same sentience to the nth number. But because S equals subject under consideration and P equals predicate, and no amount of predication, that is rational statement, about a thing can possibly exhaust a thing, I have to put back the S, say plus S, plus S. So the equation as a psychological equation is quite sound. The subject equals predication to the nth plus that of the subject, namely its wholeness, that has been left out by discussion. When you analyze a thing, do you not cut it into bits? Any dissenters, mentally? You consider the part of the being. When you consider the parts of a being, have you not taken the being away from its wholeness in order to consider the parts? Do you not leave out of consideration during an analysis the wholeness of being? So if you said, my girl's got eyes of blue, I never cared for eyes of blue, but she's got eyes of blue, and that's my weakness now. Predication. About 1924, I think. Now, when you predicate, you cut the wholeness of being intellectually. You do not cut the reality with your words. You cut the categories of consciousness. The reality remains what it was. So the S, the subject matter, which is the infinite field of sentience, is in no way cut by the intellectual analytic activities of human beings. So we have to write the S again. But it didn't make mathematical sense in the ordinary way. But when he thought about it, it actually meant that it adds up to nothing. The statement means nothing. It's a superior type of tautology. It defines itself in terms of itself. But this nothing is infinite sentience itself. It is the S. Sentience, and it climbs up from the field that posited the S and predicates about itself. Now, predator, what is a predator? Does anybody know what a predator is? It's any kind of being that seizes upon another being to extend its own life, like a cat. A tiger, a lion, jumps on a deer. then the tiger is a predator. Now, this is the same base. To predicate, to be a predator, or in German a prediger, that is a minister of the gospel, is to seize on an opportunity. When you predicate, that is, when you make an irrational statement about the infinity of possibilities in the universe, have you not done so for some purpose? If you predicate, you have a purpose. If I say my friend Trevor, there, I predicate and say Trevor is my friend, I predicate friendship. Now I have a purpose in so doing. What the purpose is, I'll leave you to guess. It might be because I know that Trevor is physically fit and a PT man, and he knows about judo and he can do a forward flip and land quite easily on his back, and he might take me with him. Maybe I'm trying to persuade him that he's my friend so that he doesn't practice any weird judo on me. Maybe. And unless I say what my purpose is, unless you are clairvoyant, you won't know. But if I do predicate at all, I am up to something. I have a purpose. P for purpose. P for predication. P for positing. P for principle. And P for pain. That makes it necessary for me to have a principle. When we consider the O here in our chest, we're thinking about a feeling not yet committed to manifestation. And we put that up here. And we say the infinity of reality can be adequately represented only by zero. Zero is an interesting word. It means zeal to differentiate, an absolute will to control, to rule. Now, in modern physics, you have exactly the same thing. You have a space-time power continuum, and space is curved so that you represent space-time power continuum with a circle. It is nothing, no thing. Thing means finite. It is not finite. It is not a thing. It is infinite. But it is infinite purple, infinite sentient power. When you use that word purple, look at it. It is made P-U-R, is it not? Poor, as in Singapore, it means city, a rationalized structure, civilization. And P-L-E means play, means folded. You know there are what you call complications. That means with folds in civilization. Poor play. The purple means rationality and playing about. Here is the playing about in the S, and there is the city, civilization, posited pi rationally in the head. So this nothing, this not a thing, this infinite sentient power, which is not a thing, comprises within itself all conceivables, whatever. There is nothing, not a thing, not included in the real significance of zero. If we then look at Buddhism, we have a word, sunyata, the Sanskrit word sunya, void. But this void means intelligence. We know that all human cultures have come from the same source. Supposing I write that word, sunya, and I divide it like this, and I read it like that. I have read yanus, yanus, a firm intelligence. The void is pure, infinite, intelligent, sentient power. It is a magical continuum of the alchemists. It is the space-time power continuum of modern physicists. Janus means a firm intelligence. There is nothing, there is no thing not included in that which is called void. We move about in what we call void space, don't we? There is a bit of space up the aisle, and a person can get up and move up or down the aisle, because apparently there is not a thing there. But if you ask science whether there is not a thing there, science would say, sorry, we could have said that into the late 19th century, but we cannot say it anymore because it is full of power. But where there is a body, like Trent Gerhardt or Margarita, where there is a body, the power is turning round and demarking that body by its rotation. But where apparently there is no thing, the power is not there apparently rotating. It is lying doggo, it is being quiet, it is going into pralaya. So then we would have pralaya where there is apparently nothing, there is entropy, and where there is a body of a living human being, we could say that is manvantara. That is the law of the manifestation, the counting, the evaluation of beings. So that mysterious word, that void, that sunya, means the very fullness. You have another word in Christian philosophy, pleroma. That same word means exactly the same. It means the very fullness where there is apparently emptiness. Now this is the whole basis of what you were talking about with the HN function and the pole. There is a higher world represented by H, and there is a lower world represented by push. Think the H is a ladder, the eighth letter, symbolizes hierarchy of intelligence, create intelligent differences. And at the other end, there is a po, which means push. Never mind the hierarchy, just thump everybody as you meet them. You go down the road, you intend to go in the supermarket, and there is a coach going by covered in gold knobs. If you don't like it, it happens you have the great strength to eat much spinach, so you go up and you push over the coach. It happens that Her Majesty is in the coach at the time, and therefore there converge upon you a lot of gentlemen called bobbies who proceed to beat the daylight out of you because you are a straight, ordinary, simple, uncomplicated, honest pusher. Any honest pusher who hasn't got any complex mental processes gets quickly locked up. Now you observe that they have used the word there, that pole function, for the exact same concept that we've used here, P-O, the zone marked with principle. Why should it be that they've used for a straight pusher the same sign that we use for principle? Because ultimately the only principle is push. But there are ways of pushing. There's a straight push, and there's a curly push. One straight push, one curly push. That is the origin of the word is. Straight push, curly push. Straight to the point, like a counsellor from Manchester who tells you the plain truth about the reason the rates have gone up. He's lying in his teeth. But he has a straightforward voice. If he worked very hard, it would become as good as Vic Feathers was. The sign of power. Say what you mean outwardly, and mean what you say, and then you will be great. But never forever really mean what you say, otherwise you'll be out of a job immediately. Subtlety, deviousness, is an essential part of civilization. And we take that eye, and we just put the little top on it, like this, because that is the sack, bag, or container of all the information then it's a pride with this rod of office. You always have a sack, a container. In our case, for ideas, it is the brain, and for children, it is the scrotum. But it is still a sack, and it contains powers, information. And you have to have the information before you can apply the rod of authority. But then you are required to apply the rod of authority subtly, or you will be in trouble. Why? Because everybody has the same potential of authority. And if you were blatantly authoritarian and made your statements openly with force, then other people would start reacting by forcing you. And that would produce chaos. Therefore, speech was invented to circumlocute the state push. Now, when we look at this POS, we can say the O is the first state, but strictly we ought to write zero for it. And the sentience, as experienced by the baby, is the second state, but to the baby is its first experience. And then when it's had its first frustration or pain, it rises up again and posits a third state, which is the second state for the developing baby. We start with zero, with the field of sentience. We mobilize it, and in so doing divide ourselves, because we are infinite, we are eternal. And yet, when we do something, our infinity becomes finity. We finite ourselves in an act. If you fight somebody and you deliver a right hook, you have finited, for the time being, your mode of activity into hooking with the right. If you give a straight left, you finite it with the straight concept. Infinity becomes finity. The unlimited becomes limited by doing something. So that the do, the letter D in it, means to divide yourself from your infinity in the act of doing. What happens then when you divide yourself in that way? You fall if you forget that you are infinite. You are a field of infinite possibilities, a field that can, in principle, do anything, posit anything. But the moment you do something, if you allow your consciousness to identify with it, you can conceive yourself to be such a person. So it's a boxer who goes into the ring and wins a fight with the right hook, knocks a man out. If he is praised too much, he will try to knock the next fellow out with the same right hook, and he may become a right hooker. And then somebody who observes the way he boxes can devise a method of avoiding a right hook and will defeat him, because he has forgotten his infinity of possibilities and posited a particular mode, a way of gaining success. When he gains that success in that way and identifies with it, he loses his infinite potentiality, his pure voidity. When you lose your voidity, you have fallen onto a particularized form of action, which action can be studied by other people, and they can devise a method of dealing with your mode of activity. But if you wipe out, as soon as you have won a bout, if you wipe out your mode of victory and return to your primordial voidity, you have an infinity of ways that you can actually fight the next time. In Zen Buddhism, you have the concept of no mind. You have the same in Chinese Buddhism, and the same thing in Dhyana Buddhism in India. The concept that your real enemy that finites you is having a mind, a mentational process that thinks linearly, serially. Now, because we have been trained with language, with letters in an alphabet, or with sounds in an ideographic structure, because we have been trained to think by means of symbols, and because the symbols are taught to us in a book, one after the other, a habit of serial, linear mentation is set up in the mind. And after many years of thinking in this way, you will find that most people, and I mean most people that you meet in human society, will actually not only think in that linear way, they will believe there is no other way. How many of you here believe that there is another way of filling the voidity of the unconscious other than by thinking linearly, thinking serially? Already we have some potential wizards amongst us. Actually, any woman knows what I'm talking about. But that doesn't mean that she knows reflexively what we are talking about. We are talking about a mode of apprehension of reality that does not depend on linear word forms. There is a mode of knowing which does not depend on thinking in terms of ideas which are based on words learned from outside. When you acquire a vocabulary as a child from your parents and later from school, the vocabulary given to you has something to do with the purposes of the teacher, something to do with the establishment in the human being of a linear pattern of procedure, so that you are taught to get up in the morning and to go and do something for so many hours, and then come home and get a meal, and then having had it to go out to a place of entertainment, and then come home drunk or sober and go to bed and repeat the next day. Now, by the establishment of this cycle of behavior, civilization is created and maintained. And without that civilization, we could not have the possibility of freedom. Because that civilization is the primordial way whereby we get out of chaos and establish a stable reference from which we can then proceed to move freely. In the chaos before the establishment of civilization, you cannot move freely. Just imagine primitive peoples, say 2 million years ago, food gathering in the forest. And they have spread out by reproduction so that the forest is full of people and they are all looking for food. What happened when they encountered each other, when they saw the blackberries on the bush? Did they immediately say, "After you," or did they rush for the bush? The tendency was for them to fight for the available food. So there was a chaos. There was a situation in which any man could be beaten to pieces by any other man, or any tribe defeated, perhaps exterminated, by another tribe. Like motorway cafes, yeah. And generally speaking, the crockery would be of the same degree of cleanliness. So that, in fact, there had to be established a civilization. That means an order of procedure. Now, you started with Taoism, Trevor. We might as well take the same basis again. China. The opposite to Taoism in China is Confucianism. And Confucianism was the system of rules for establishing a civilization. And once the civilization is thoroughly established by Confucianist training of the child, when the child becomes mature enough to recognize the value of its routine procedures for maintaining the non-chaotic serial order of civilization, then it was allowed to go to Taoist school, where it was studying how to be free. In Confucianism, you're taught to have a mind which knows the exact size of everything, the exact size of a fork, a knife, a spoon, a ring to wear, shoes, platforms, soles, whatever it was. Everything had a legitimate ritual size and shape. And thus civilization was given its form. But when that form had been thoroughly established, then the few people who were ready, who were no longer children, no longer needing the civilization, because they had understood it, they could then go, like Confucius himself did, to Lao Tse. They could go to Taoist school to learn freedom. That does not mean they'd immediately rush about and smash society. It would mean they would then move about deviously within society, so they did not upset the social rule, but nevertheless they themselves transcended it. They did not break it, they lived sinuously amongst the rules without disturbing the rules and without being conditioned by the rules, and that is the Taoist way of living. And that way of Tao is summed up in that very first little verse of the 81 chapters of Tao Te Ching. The Tao, the way, the Tao, the way the universe operates that can be named is not the true Tao. It's not the true way. If you can name it, it cannot be true, because naming is already limiting, finiting, defining, designating. So the Tao that can be named is not the true one. So what is the true one? The true one is the one that cannot be named. Well, then how do you refer to it? You refer to it as the nameless. Now in Sanskrit you have the term nama rupa, where nama means name and rupa means form. Nama refers to your mental content and rupa to the form of sensible experience. You name the forms of your experience, and in the process of naming them, you wrench them out of the context of their infinite association, and you cut down on the infinity of that association. You reduce them to finitude, to limitation in themselves, in their parts, and in their relation to other parts. So as soon as you name, if I say Trevor is a boy, immediately the association in most minds thinks, well, Trevor is equipped with a terrible impedance because he is a boy. And women, you see, girls are not so impeded. They are free. They have nothing, but he has something. And his something is always getting him into trouble, because it is only a half-truth. The thing that he has, he's always looking for that which it has not. And what it has not is nothing. The P seeks the S. It seeks sensuous experience, experience and verification of principle. The man has a principle. He has an appendage. And the pending, the imminent danger which he has encountered, the memory of it has risen up from his sensuous experience and posited itself in his head as principle. And it conducts his life for him and restricts him and makes him, like Brutus, an honorable man. So the men are tremendously limited because they suffer. And I mean suffer. Our impassive relationship to principle, the limiting factor on sensuality. But woman has no such limiting appendage, and therefore she is not in any way limited. But the I in the letter S signifies male rigidity, adherence to principle, and the S signifies serpentine deviousness of the woman. So that by her deviousness she can actually escape the rigidity of the principle that obsesses man. Man actually believes and has found over thousands of years that if he has no principle, no other man will trust him. But by the same law, the dialectic of Tao, if he has got a principle, no woman can trust him. Because the essence of her being is that she is like the void. She is free, absolutely. But she cannot express her freeness within a civilization, the rules of which are built by man. So a woman will tell you it is a man's world. She means it's a world made rigid by principles. And so she has to move about like a Taoist amidst a Confucianist world. Now, all these are polarizations of the human being. From a primordial, infinite, sentient power field, by self-polarization, that field itself polarizes itself, it mobilizes itself in sensuous seeking for pleasure. And in so mobilizing itself, it leaves its infinity and posits a finite course. No matter how bent, no matter how devious, it is finite. It posits that course, and then, through persistently following it, it identifies with it and forgets its infinity. And then it comes up against frustration, because it has finited itself. In the very act of self-finiting has come self-refutation, because actually that sensuousness wishes for infinite sensuous enjoyment. But by committing itself to the process of finite self-sensuous seeking, it has limited its mode of gaining its satisfaction. So there is the creation of P out of S. By the frustration and the pain of frustration, sensuous self-seeking for delights has posited a principle, a limiting principle. That is to say, when you seek this pleasure, when you seek your sensuous delight, you necessarily commit yourself to a particular type of activity, and the particularization means limitation, finiting process, and this is frustration, and this gives you pain. And then this pain, you throw it backwards and up, and it becomes your brain. It becomes the box in which you hold, recorded, all the memories of the painful situations that you have suffered, and these painful situations in their totality are what men call principle. Remember, O-B-S, ops, as in optics. The eye, the observer. There must be an observer of the infinite process, otherwise the infinite process would not comprehend itself. So infinity posits a finite observer and encloses that observer in a skin. And having done so, infinity, positing it, establishes a behavior pattern through that being, through that human individual, if you like, through the animal, through the plant. But as far as we are concerned, the individual human being is a center through which infinity operates and establishes a mode of procedure which becomes habitual, and this habitual behavior becomes a limiting factor which frustrates the being that has been finited in the skin. And from this frustration, from this finiting, arises pain, and from the pain, the verbalization of principle. And principle means that which, if you obey it, you can avoid the pain. Now, the only way you can avoid certain kinds of pains is by not having the pleasures that give rise to the pains. So there is a dialectic inside the human being. The human being is an O, a pure voidity, which is a potential of a polarization. It is a being that is able to move towards sensuous experience, delight, pleasures, and a being that can t- turn itself through pains into principle to control itself. Now both of these processes, the sensuous S function and the principle P function, are polarizations of the human soul which can never be eliminated. That soul is a zone of eternal, infinite sentient power. You cannot eliminate it. The souls of human beings are eternal because they are simply zones within the only reality, the infinite sentient power. And this polarization occurs within simply because it is this purple being, this being that knows that if it does not restrain itself in some way, it cannot control the effects of its own actions. And the means whereby it controls itself is by establishing principle. The principle is nothing but the record of all the ways in which you can be frustrated. But when you establish these principles clearly, then you can avoid, you can reduce to the void many of the negative undesirable effects of the pursuit of the sensuous. Yes. If you remember that you are a trinity, that is to say you are a feeling field of sentient power with a capacity for self-mobilization towards sensuousness and towards principled consideration of the results of this sensuous pursuit, then in remembering it you have comprehended the whole process. In the Bhagavad Gita it says, a mnemonic sentence, worship is continual remembrance. Call that Wicca for short. Worship is continual remembrance. Will, intelligence, consciousness, discriminative rulership. Will, intelligence, consciousness, discriminative rulership. And call it Wicca. And then tell yourself it is Wicca's world and mean it. This word, Wicca, an old name in Anglo-Saxon for a parliament of intelligent beings. Let's put it on a shield like this and divide the shield like that, and on this side we have the word quick, and on this side we have the word dog. Ka there is the base of canine. The whole shield says quick dog. Wicca. On the sinister side you have the dog, the faithful, the tail wagger, the lamppost spoiler. And the analysis in those days is very simple. There are two kinds of bipeds that go about dressed. Those that behave like dogs, we call those cynics, which is Greek for dog. The cynics, the unbelievers, and on this side, the quick. That Christ refers to when he says, the quick and the dead. The Wicca was a method of thinking about social relations. There are masses of people called dogs, and they behave like dogs. They rush about in packs, they defecate and micturate, if there isn't any room in the toilets attached to the football ground, they will go in somebody's back garden. There have actually been reported complaints from citizens who have found that at times of vast meetings of the dogs that they've had to clean their gardens up. Suppose you have a nice musical get-together on the 21st of June in the summer solstice, and you might have 100,000 people playing guitars, and they've kindly had put up by the local council three toilets. It's a real problem, isn't it? It sounds trivial, but if you find that the boot of your car has been used, and I know a case of that actually happened, you know how easy it is to get into car boots. If you know where to buy your keys and the car, it's the usual kind of car. You can always go in the shop and buy a key to fit it, can't you? A friend of mine actually had quite a shock one day when a fellow friend of his who let a flat over his shop and found out the flat had been sublet by the tenant, so that there were 11 people living in this flat, and when he told them they had to go, and after much disagreement they left, and he went in to see what damage they'd done, he found that every drawer in the chest of drawers had been filled, had been used for defecation, and he was astonished, until I explained to him that the Southern Irish are not terribly fond of the English, and then he understood it. This was a slight payment for British oppression of Ireland years ago. The mark was still there. Now, it is against that kind of behaviour that the civilised try to defend themselves. Today we call it vandalism, don't we? Don't we now actually think in terms of vandalism more or less lightly? I remember the time when it was a surprising thing. If you went to a cinema in town and you parked your car in a side street, it was surprising if somebody broke into it. Now it's surprising if they don't. And does not everybody actually accept this as part of civilization's protest mood, that we actually do have thousands and thousands of people busy protesting by smashing any restraining influences that they come across? Now, this analysis was made a long time ago, and the wick, the quick, the wick in the candle that controls the rate at which you burn your life force. To be quick, to be conscious, to be an individual, to have self-control, that is to be on the dexter side of the shield, the right side, and to have no control, to be stimulated from outside, to be reduced to fury by the losing team happening to be yours, to be reduced to violence by a slight difference of political opinion, a granite disturbance about a union quarrel and people get beaten up. Doesn't this happen? Of course it happens. You can't listen to a news bulletin any single day without hearing some violence somewhere in the world. Now, how is it going to be cured? Not by curing other people. Other people don't cure. The only way that it can be done is by each individual deciding to examine his own polarization, because he too is a bit of a dog, given the opportunity, and he too is quick when he remembers to be. And he has a slogan, worship is continual remembrance. Remembrance of what? Remembrance of the fact that he is a will, he is an intelligence, he is consciousness, he is discriminative self-rulership. By this process of self-control, any individual can fit himself for pure isness. He can be an I, a being that is reflexively self-aware, and he can be an S. He can be devious. Christ says to you, be harmless, but be wise as serpents, because you are living amongst dogs. You are living amongst beings that will tear you to pieces unless you are subtle in the way you behave, the way you express yourself. You can see perfectly easily. You cannot convert another person from outside by propaganda. It has got to come from inside. From outside can come an exhortation. But as the Bishop of London said a few years ago, 2,000 years of exhortation has produced precisely no effect. Exhortation from the outside does not do anything of any worth or any permanence. It can only come from inside. And that means that the individual has to recognize in himself that polarization of his own being, the separation of that Juan and that Po, the separation of your hierarchical consciousness from your simple pushing nature. This separation must occur. You must analyze yourself to see that you have actually got a hierarchical awareness of the necessity of differences of level, and you also have a tendency to push, and that these two are separate functions. They are not separate essences in the continuum. They are separate functions, in fact, in a time, matter, body world. You can think without moving physically. You can feel without moving physically. And yet, you can also think, become heated, become emotional, and the emotion can run into your nervous system and release nervous energy, contract muscles, and make you move. There is a real meaning in separativity of function, because by that separativity you gain self-control. And by that self-control, you gain total self-determination. You go from your pure nothingness, the voidity of pure sentient power, to positing a world that you define clearly as worthy of positing. Instead of living in a world posited for you by other beings with their own interests, you design a world and posit that world yourself, and you live in it. And to posit that world requires you to think in principle very hard. And the principle you come out with is that if I posit a world that other beings object to and know about, they will oppose me, they will defeat me. So I must posit a world that is acceptable to other beings. And yet somehow that same world must be a world in which I can live, in which I can create, in which I can express myself. But not so crudely as to create the opposition that would destroy my expression. Now, we live in a universe that today is not theoretically, but actually demonstrably power. The 19th century material atom is gone. Only a few lazy fuddy-duddies believe that matter is matter in the unbreakable sense. Matter today is a wavicle of probability. It is nothing but a probability, a tendency. It is not an established permanent fact. The reality is energy, the reality is power, the reality is sentience, is consciousness. Now, consciousness is a catalyst. That is, when you know a thing, it alters the way of approach to that thing. It alters the behavior of the world as you become conscious of what the world is, because you approach the world in a totally different way. When you have a different consciousness of reality, you approach consciousness, present it to the world, and the world reflects the content of the consciousness, and the world changes. So that you do not actually deal with the same world when you are conscious of it that you were dealing with beforehand. Because before you were conscious, you were dealing with inertia. And when you are conscious, you are not dealing with inertia, you are dealing with initiative. Because then you initiate, you do not act habitually, so that you don't continue to preserve the old world, you act with initiative and you change the world. The world is changing, the world is kinetic, the world is dynamic, the world is creative, if you know it. But if you do not know that the world is dynamic, kinetic, creative, you think that there is a world that is unchangeable and acts according to those laws. That rather funny, scared comedian Descartes divided the world into mind and matter. As a result of which, for over 200 years, we have suffered from a concept that there is a world which is ruled by unalterable law. And that all that science can do is study the world, learn the laws, and obey those laws. And those laws are rigid. absolutely, and up to the end of the 19th century, most intelligent religious people said the laws are established by God and are therefore permanent. But that left no room for freedom at all. But the function of God is to create free beings, not bound beings, creative beings. And therefore all the laws, without exception, that science has discovered in the last 2,500 years, those laws are elastic. They are flexible laws. They are laws of tendency. They are not rigid laws of matter. And that means that even a material body, so-called, can be influenced by the intelligence of the human being. We live today when we have daily debates and arguments on radio and TV about ESP, about extrasensory perception, about the possibility of poltergeists, about the possibility of telepathy, the possibility of dowsing, finding more to hazel twigs, and so on. And many, many people are sceptical about these things and think it's rubbish because they are old-fashioned people and out of date. The reality is that sensitivity increases the more you use it. And the more you use your sensitivity, the more flexible become the principles. Until finally you can actually adjust what you previously thought was gross material, fixed reality, by an act of will. Now in that case you do not need to be tyrannized over by any preconception that your educators have imposed upon you, because you can reconceive yourself. That means you are essentially creative. Right down to your bones. You think your bones are the most solid thing, the most naively thought realist thing in your body. The bones are real. You can knock bones, you can break bones. Those are really real. And muscles are nearly as real. And glandular secretions are not quite so real. And emotions are even less real. And abstract thoughts are even less real. So there's a whole school of nominalists who say abstract thoughts are really nothing except names. But they are all energies. And when you manipulate an idea, you have started to manipulate the world. A world so that when you get an idea and you emote on the idea, you charge the idea with feeling, the feeling creates chemistry in your body. But it doesn't only create chemistry in your body. It creates chemistry in anybody's body who gets near you. And I don't mean near you spatially, I mean near you emotionally. So that a person in Australia now of a similar idea and similar feeling to you is actually emotively in contact with you. And it could happen that you would get a message from the other side of the world simply because you have changed your mind and changed the effective charge on your mind. And in the process you have changed the constitution of the world, right down to the bones, right down to the mineral world, the so-called rocks, the unshakable, the everlasting mountains. They are nothing except power vibrating in a certain way. They are modelable. There can be landslides, there can be earthquakes, there can be all kinds of marvelous things, starting their changes at the level of initiative. Now, initiative is a gift, a talent of the human being, evolved in the human being through the infinite sentient power, which in religion is called God. God, that infinite field of power, has posited in the human being initiative, the power to change things. He has posited in the human being sentience, sensibility to his own condition, and therefore he has posited in the human being a creativity that does not exist at any other level, either below or above. The angels are not so complex as the human being, nor are they as free as the human being. An angel is already circumscribed by the plan put into it by the absolute sentient power, by God. And a human being is mixed partly of the earth, the fallen earth, the diabolic, and partly of the Spirit of God. And therefore, by contemplating his own devilishness, his own diabolical intent, his own sensuality, by contemplation of these, he creates tension inside himself that does not occur at any other level. Man stands exactly halfway between God and the devil, between free spirit and bound basalt, the rock formation. He is the between. He is the middleman, between infinity and finity, between the unlimited sentient power and the limited, finite, sentient mind inside the skin of a human being. So therefore man is a most peculiar being, a being with a high potential of creativity which he seldom realizes. And when he does, the rest of them are astonished. They look at Michelangelo's David and they are astonished. How did a man do it? He did it by studying principles of form and by calling upon his sensuous enjoyment of the principle. Instead of having the principle fighting the sensuousness and the sensuousness fighting the principle, he had the sensuous enjoying the principle and the principle guiding the sensuous. Just as surely as a violinist guides his fingers over a fretless keyboard to find the note he wants by sensitivity, which he knows is there by principle. My friend Len over there, who makes music come out of a double bass, has a long piece of string, and he can put a finger on that string and produce a note. The note he wants. Does he measure it? Do you start from the note with a measuring tape, Len? How do you find that note?
You just feel.
That's a fact. If he had to measure it with a measuring tape, could he play? Would he have time? Excuse me, conductor, I found this note. Oh, there it is. He couldn't do it. But in fact, he can go very fast. And he can give you a rhythmical counterpoint to something else played by another instrument, and how he does it, he doesn't know, except that he feels it. And this feeling is very mysterious. It feels that. Have you ever actually measured along that fingerboard, then?
Never.
And yet you can find the note you want. Isn't it funny? You could say, well, of course, empirically, he must have measured it at some time when he was a boy, and he looked at it and remembered where it was, and therefore he can put his finger there. But that has not happened. And I've never met a player of a fretless instrument that has measured his fingerboard and decided where he's going to put his finger. But by a peculiar process of self-sensitization, he has found his note and he can feel where it is, even with his eyes closed. Now, how is that? When I was a little boy and my father was teaching me piano, he put a sheet over the keyboard and said, now find C sharp, 2 octaves above middle C. I couldn't see any keys, I had to go like that. There it is. So it's all the same to me, whether there's a sheet over the keyboard or the room is in total darkness. Once you sit down there, you feel the width of the piano and the whole thing is structured like a field. And that's how a professional musician plays more expertly than another person who doesn't actually trust the power of his feeling. And this is the same thing. Music is called the type of the arts, because the rules in all the arts are sort of derivative from the rules that govern music: space, time, power. The space between notes, the silences, the time, the tempo in which you play it, the power, how heavily you strike that note or pluck that string. Space, time, power are the principles governing music. Space, time, power are the principles ruling on the chessboard. Anybody who plays chess without space, time, power, consciousness is not a good chess player. You must be aware of the 64 squares you've got to play with. You must know that a queen is roughly 8 times more powerful than a pawn at a certain stage of the game, and that a rook is half of the queen at a certain stage of the game. You are dealing with space-time power. If you were to sit down and write down the possibilities of every move, you would never move. And in match, ordinary match chess, you've got to make a move every 5 minutes. So there is a power in the human being. And that power is accessible. But how do we get at it? We have been trained in civilization in a Confucianist manner to keep the drains out of the road, etc., etc., all the social conveniences. We have been trained in a linear manner by means of words. So we have a vocabulary of words taught to us in a linear way, and these keep us on a linear track. Now, as long as we are thinking linearly, we are not thinking wholly. And we have a mind that thinks linearly, but we have another called a no mind, meaning non-linear limited mind, no linear limitations. This mind is a gestalt mind. It is a mind that comprehends universal pattern. It is there, and it can be got at. How is it got at? Very, very simply, you do what the Japanese would call sitting in Zazen. What you do is look in your mind with widespread consciousness, not convergent on a particular word, not convergent on a particular phrase, not convergent on a particular sentence. You look inside your being and you still the linear process. You stop it. It wasn't there until your educators gave it to you, and you can stop it. And when you stop that linear process, the energy that is stored inside your mind, because you know your brain is full of millions and millions of impressions, and yet with linear thinking you can get it only one at a time. And yet if you still your mind, you are in the center of an infinite field of information. And from this central position, all points are equidistant. There is an infinity of information present when you still the mind. And that is called a no mind, a void. But that void is full. It is sunya. You are affirming nous, intelligence, when you still your mind. And the more you practice stilling the mind, instilling that mind in that way, you are attaining not less information, but more information. And the more you follow a linear series in pursuit of information, the less information you get, because all you get is the linear associations given to you by your educators. So the rule is very, very simple. Have a no mind. Stop linearity. How do you do it? By remembering that infinity is a big now here. Omniscience is here now. It isn't yesterday or tomorrow, because those yesterdays and tomorrows are figments. They are intellectual conceptions of the analytical mind. What we are actually inside is a universe that is immediately, totally present in that here now. We have been trained in a linear way to think that Sunday precedes Monday, precedes Tuesday, and so on. We've had this condition till we actually lose contact with the week as a whole. Yet one generation tells another. And by a study of the law of cycles, you become aware that there is a totality of information available if you can stand still. And you stand still in the here now. Now, you can only do this if you believe it. And you can only believe it if you love it. Because believe in believe means love. If you love the idea that there is eternity, like Vaughan said, I saw eternity the other night, like a white ring of endless light. And we are in that eternity. And we are in no sense cut off from that eternity. We cannot be cut off from that eternity which is God. And St. Paul says, I am persuaded that nothing can separate us from the love of God. Now, if you are moving in the right direction, if your motivation is pure, you can afford to believe that you are a modality of an infinite continuum with a capacity for stilling the linear serial thinking process and finding instead of nothing, all things in an infinite sphere of intelligent light. How do you feel then? What is it like? You know that intelligent light, the light that's experienced first in that Bardo, immediately after you die, you experience this total light, and you can experience it also without waiting to die by simply cutting linear thinking. And that intelligent light is God. It is pure consciousness which precipitated within itself this world, which we tend to believe is concrete, real, enduring, permanent, indestructible. Whereas in fact it is dynamic, kinetic, infinitely modelable by the mind and will of man as representative of that infinite field itself. If you still the mind, in success you will find at certain points your nervous system will jump. That simply means that nervous energy that previously went through some neurological pathway has escaped out of the routine. Don't be afraid. If you're sitting there in this process of meditation, you are sitting there quite still, and you are thinking not at all in the linear sense, but you are absolutely alert. You have not fallen into stupid unconsciousness. You are very alert and you are looking, because it is an empirical thing. This experience of the light is as much an experiment to the individual finding it as a physical experiment of a scientist in the laboratory. It is really an empirical process of self-spiritualization. You sit. After a time, the energy that previously went along certain neurological pathways inside you, because you are not letting it run in a linear way, the energy escapes from those nerve lines and suddenly your body jumps. The evidence, that jump, that some energy has leaked out of a habitual pathway. Don't be scared when it jumps. Think, I mustn't be disturbed by this jump. If I'm not careful, I'll go back into linear thinking about the jump. And if you do that, you will retard yourself. When the jump occurs, say, nervous energy leak, back to the non-serial process. As you do this, the energy will mount, the tension across the nerves will increase, and you will begin to feel more and more and more alert. And at a certain crucial point, you will find in the base of the spine a sort of heating process occurring. And again, do not let yourself fall into linear attempts at analysis of the cause. You will actually feel very hot in the base of the spine, and there will be a sort of swirling, smoky feeling. And then quite suddenly this energy will rush up. And as it goes up through various knots, plexi, nerve knots in the spine, it will tend to flash out. You'll get a sensation of flash of information. Again, you are in danger of linear thinking. Ignore them. The rule is ignore these phenomena, otherwise you will not get to the highest. When it flashes out, ignore it and sit, looking, fully alert, waiting, not linearly thinking, but very, very alert. Gradually it will go, then it will start to accelerate, it will rise up, and when it hits your brain, it will trigger the total information of your total ancestry right back prior to human race, beyond all animals, plants, bacteria. It will go right back into the cosmic field, and your whole brain will then suddenly flash with light, and you will find yourself outside your skull with a sort of mass of light. And when you do that, don't fall into linearity. Don't get tricked and say, my God, that's interesting. I must tell my friend Roger about that tomorrow. Because as soon as you think linearly, you're back in time. You lose it. Suddenly the light goes away and you're just an ordinary guy again. And you're back on your linear process. But you do have a memory that you broke it, and that can encourage you. You can start again. The tendency, the temptation. Temptation means temporal stimulus, temporal presentation. The stimulus that drags you back into linearity, into serial thinking. When you do it, fight it as soon as you can. Wicca's world, worship is continual remembrance. I will, my intelligence, my consciousness, my discriminative rulership. I reunify myself and I become here, now, nothing, except pure observation. And in that pure observation, this light comes back again. And with it, shalom, salam, peace. You find that your spirit, S, and your M, your so-called material being, are bound together, L, S, L, M, salam, shalom, peace. Because you discover your own polarity is your own work. You reunify yourself absolutely.